fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I'm Jim Harold. Glad to be with you once again. And we have a repeat guest. He's been on the Paranormal Podcast multiple times. And we're glad to have back on one of our programs, Paul Kimball. He's a very accomplished filmmaker, a documentarian. He's also worked with some feature film. In addition, he's an author of multiple books. He's been on all kinds of radio and TV shows, including Coast to Coast. And just an overall very erudite guy, one of my favorite people to talk to about the paranormal. And today, our discussion is going to be a little bit different because it's going to revolve around a very good friend of Paul's, Mac Tonnies, the late Mac Tonnies, who was a blogger and author, often researched and wrote about the paranormal. And Mac unfortunately passed at a very young age a few years ago, but he left behind a rich larder, if you will, of writings via his blog. And Paul has compiled said writings into a book called Post-Human Blues, Dispatches from a World on the Cusp of Terminal Dissolution, Volume 1. And we're going to talk to Paul about Mac, about Mac's work, and what conclusions we can draw from it. Paul, welcome back to one of our programs. So good to talk to you again.
Hi, Jim. Good to be back. Always good to be back on any of your programs, and especially good to be back to talk not about my own work, but about the work of somebody who was one of my best friends, Mac Tonnies. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about the Post-Human Blues.
Now, many of us who have followed the paranormal have heard Mac's name. Maybe we've read something. Maybe we heard him on Coast to Coast or something like that. But being someone who is very, very close to him, explain to people who Mac Tonnies was.
Sure. Mac was from Kansas City, Missouri, actually originally from Independence, Missouri. So if I always say Kansas City, but I know that people in Independence get upset with me when I say Kansas City because they're actually from Independence. He was born and raised there. He went to college, got a bachelor's degree in English literature. Excuse me. And then he spent most of the rest of his life working a series of 9-to-5 jobs at places like Starbucks and other places as he was trying to build a career for himself as a writer. He's a tremendous writer, very interested in science fiction. He published at a very young age a collection of science fiction short stories called Illumined Black, which good luck trying to find it now. It's out of print, and I think, you know, like anybody else who dies, the value of their work goes up once they've passed away. So the same is true of Max. I think it was the last time I saw a copy, it was hundreds of dollars that they were selling it for on eBay or something like that. And then he had two other books. One was After the Martian Apocalypse, which he released, I think it was in 2004. Well, he didn't release, Simon & Schuster did. And that was about Martian anomalies and extraterrestrial exploration, that is to say us going out there as opposed to them coming here. And his last book, which was published, besides the ones that I'll be publishing, that was published posthumously, was The Crypto-Terrestrials, which was a pretty small volume with some pretty interesting ideas in it, sort of thought speculations, thought experiments, where he would talk about this civilization that might have existed, might continue to exist alongside ours, and might be responsible for many of the things that we call the paranormal, particularly the UFO phenomenon. So he was a great thinker with a wide range of ideas, a wide range of interests. Most people that would know him for his work in the paranormal. But he had this blog. It was called The Post-Human Blues. It ran, I think he started in 2003. Well, I know he started in 2003 because that's when the first volume of the book series starts, 2003. So he got into blogging in 2003, and his blog, he would float ideas. He would talk about the paranormal in his blog. So in the books that we're doing, some of the paranormal stuff is in there too. But he wasn't just a paranormal guy. He had a wide range of interests. He talks about literature, science fiction. He talks about politics. In the first volume, he talks a great deal about politics because it was the ending of the first years of the first administration for George Bush. And he was not a supporter of George Bush. He's very, very anti-Bush. So he's in the run-up to the 2004 election. We see him talking about politics. We see him talking about American culture and American society. And he's writing. It's to me, it's a I wanted to do this for two reasons, three reasons, really. One, I believe everything should be in book form because I'm a Luddite. So Max material was out on the internet. A very good friend of his who goes by the online handle of Captain Mark sort of saved it and cached it, which means it will continue to exist as long as he continues to do that. But who knows what's going to happen with the internet? Who knows what's going to happen with technology? I don't know. Maybe someday his blog will just disappear, even if the internet continues on. But books, my friend, books never disappear. Even no matter how much people try and burn them, they're still books, you know. So by editing down and publishing his stuff, I weeded out the chaff, because a lot of the stuff, he posts pictures of Natalie Portman or stuff, and typical blogging stuff. Hey, look, new picture of Natalie Portman. I have a crush on her. Well, okay. You'd have to weed through all that to get to his writings and his opinions on stuff. So I went through, took the first 2 years, there's a couple more volumes coming out, and edited it down to 360 pages of his observations on all sorts of stuff. And I think that's the real reason I wanted to do it. Is tremendous, as a historian myself, trained as a historian when I was younger, it's a those kinds of primary documents by people who lived in a particular age are things that people 20, 50, 100 years from now are going to appreciate. So I'm not going to say that Mac's work is going to be viewed quite like Samuel Pepys's work, you know, the great English diarist who told us about his time. But maybe it will be, because I think it's a seminal document from a guy of a certain age living in a certain time, namely the first decade of the 21st century, from a certain, you know, Midwest America. He's in the flyover state, and he's surrounded by all these people that he finds don't quite fit into his way of thinking. He would have been much more comfortable in New York or Seattle or San Francisco or LA, but he was, I won't say stuck, because he liked his home, but he was kind of stuck intellectually in the center of the United States during the Bush administration, which was a fate that he was desperately trying to get out of as quickly as he could, but he never quite made it. And that makes it a very interesting story. Separating myself from my close friendship with him, just as a historian, that makes it a very interesting document that I want to give people the opportunity to read it, and to read it not as a blog with all this clutter that he would put in, but to read the good bits, the important bits taken out in a series, in a diary, basically in a diary, as if he'd been keeping a journal. So that's what I did. His parents and I get along great. So they turned over the rights to the blog to me and my publishing company, and said, you know, they trusted me, which I'll be forever grateful for, with his literary legacy. And I edited the book, got a historian in the United States named Aaron Gullius to write a very good foreword about what Mac's work meant, both in terms of the paranormal and in terms of society in general. And then we published it in November to a pretty good response, actually. So, yeah, there's more to come. I'm actually working on editing the second volume now, which will cover the years 2005 to 2006. And then the third volume should be out towards the end of 2013, which will cover the final 3 years of his life from 2007 to 2009.
When it comes to the paranormal, what was the uniqueness of his take on it? What was maybe a little different than what others offer in that regard?
Well, the reason he and I hit it off, we began a sort of internet correspondence around 2000, because we were both subscribers to something called the UFO Updates List, which is run by a nice guy out of Canada named Errol Bruce Knapp. And it was a place where it was really the go-to place back at that time. You could find Stan Friedman there, Don Ledger, Kevin Randall, all these, Bruce McAbee, all the top name UFO researchers were contributing to this list. So if you were even remotely interested in UFOs, that was the place to sort of join up and either contribute, as Mac and I did, or even lurk sometimes. So I noticed these postings by this guy named Mac Tonies on this list, and I said, I like the cut of this guy's jib. I just like the way he thinks. So I got in touch with him, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say. We became best friends. But what I liked about it was he thought the same way I did, which is not to say that we agreed on everything. In fact, we disagreed on a whole bunch of things, but that he was open-minded. He was imaginative. He was willing to speculate and to indulge in these thought experiments. He wasn't tied down to any particular theory. He wasn't tied down to any particular answer to what UFOs were, or what the paranormal was. He understood, as I think I understand, that it's a mystery. And that's what makes it interesting. it's why we get along. Eventually, I introduced him to my friends Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop. We sort of formed what somebody, and I can never remember who, called us the Paranormal Rat Pack. Dean and Sammy and all those guys. And, I brought them all up here in 2006. I had a conference in Halifax, which I lost a lot of money on, like thousands of dollars on. It didn't matter to me. I had this conference. I brought Stan Friedman in as well. He was speaking, and one or two other guys. But there were the four of us. The only time the four of us were ever in the same place. And only 50 people showed up. I held it at a university here, and I didn't care. Well, I did care a bit. I wish I had the money back, but you know, I flew them all up here. I put them all up for 3 or 4 days, and I didn't even film it, which is the dumbest thing I've ever done in my career. I was a filmmaker, and I didn't even film it, which I don't know why. To this day, I didn't do that. So unless you were there, there's no record of it. It's something that you could only experience if you were there, but we were all there, and it was just listening to him speak. I mean, Nick gave a great talk. Greg gave a great talk. Stan gave the same talk he always gives, which is a great talk. I gave a talk. But we all had notes. Stan had slides. I had a PowerPoint presentation because I'm a little more modern than Stan is. Nick had PowerPoint. Great. Mac had none of that. Mac just walked up to the podium and for an hour and a half, without any notes, spoke extemporaneously and had the 50 people, including my parents, in the audience riveted in attention. Because what he was talking about was the future of the human race. He was talking about artificial intelligence. He was talking about transhumanism and posthumanism. And I remember this. I think I mentioned this in the book, my own book, The Other Side of Truth, at one point. He said, do we deserve to survive as a race, as a species? And his answer was, I'm not sure. Whoa. You know.
Yeah, that's provocative.
Dude, I just brought you up here to talk about UFOs. Like, what are you doing? You're scaring people. Look, that girl over there is crying. Well, it wasn't quite that bad, but people were like shocked. And listen to me, I'm talking like a Valley girl. People were like shocked, man. People were shocked. But as he went along, it was this hour and a half long thought experiment. He was almost having a conversation with himself, but talking to 50 or 60 people in the audience. And I just remember sitting there. We'd already become best chums. But I just remember sitting there and thinking, you know what? I like this guy. Like, I just can't get over it. I have a man crush on Mac Tonis. And maybe in his own way, he had a man crush on me. I don't know. But we just hit it off. I do it with Greg, and I do it with Nick, and I do it with Aaron Gullius. And, you know, bouncing ideas off and having those kind of conversations. That's the guy he was. And that is the guy, to some extent, that comes out in the Post-Human Blues. He was also cranky. There's no question. He was misanthropic. He was unhappy at many points with his own life, but with society around him. So he had a tremendous wicked sense of humor, but he was also sort of this curmudgeon figure that would poke at the establishment and would tweak the nose, no matter what it was, whether it was in government or the ufological establishment or any establishment. He was always there to take a poke at it and to take a poke at himself, too. He was very self-deprecating. And I just saw in him sort of a less obnoxious, less hubristic mirror of myself. You know, it's like, because his ego wasn't as big as mine. So more people liked him than me. But yeah, he was just a lovely, wonderful guy. And I miss him terribly. But the work that he left behind, he could have done so many more things. We eventually wrote a science fiction play together called Doing Time, which was well-reviewed here in Halifax. I took it out to Boulder, Colorado for a fringe festival in 2008, got good reviews there. And we were working on screenplays together. We were talking about doing books together. I mean, it was a really crushing kind of moment. Certainly, nobody was crushed more than his parents because he was an only child. He didn't have any brothers and sisters. But I was crushed. I'm not sure I have gotten over his death since. I lost a writing partner. I lost a business collaborator. And I lost one of my two or three best friends at an age when you would never expect that to happen. And more importantly, you and I and everybody else lost somebody that should have had another 40, 50, 60 years of contributing really thought-provoking work on a wide range of subjects to us. And that's all gone now. So all that we can do is look back to what he did leave us with and try and provide a place for as much of that to be accessed by the public as possible, which is what I'm trying to do now.
Now, one thing I want to mention, due to his early death, and I do want to talk about some of his specific theories on the paranormal, but there is a contingent out there on the internet who has speculated because of the theories he was going into and the work he was doing, perhaps his passing at the age of 34 may have been more sinister than just natural causes. As one of his best friends, I wanted to give you the opportunity to comment on that and your thoughts on that kind of meme that has kind of spread since his death in 2009.
Sure. Unfortunately, the meme hasn't spread very far, but I have seen it too. I don't think I've ever commented on it publicly, and I'm pretty sure I'll never comment on it again publicly. But I will here, because this is a good opportunity, and I appreciate you asking me. He died of natural causes. There's no question. It's offensive to his parents and hurtful to his parents to hear this kind of stuff. It's offensive to me. It's offensive to anyone who knew him. He wasn't killed by the CIA or the FBI or Majestic 12. He had a heart problem that was undiagnosed, and he didn't live the healthiest lifestyle either. It's a bad combination. He drank a lot of caffeine and coffee. He kept weird hours. He's in his blog, which you can see in the book. He's often talking about the strange hours he's keeping, his circadian rhythms being off. And he had been having some health problems even before that point. Certainly nothing that would have led you to expect that he was going to pass away. But when he did, the first thing that went through my mind wasn't something like suicide or homicide or any of those sorts of things. It was, it surprises me and shocks me, but in a way it doesn't, because he sort of had this kind of lifestyle, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I lived the same lifestyle, frankly. You might hear about me in 2 weeks passing away from the same problem. You stay up late, you consume large amounts of, in my case, Diet Coke, in his case, Starbucks coffee, or wherever it was he was working. He drank espresso like it was going out of style. So, it was natural causes. Nobody offed him. There was no reason to off him. He just, unfortunately, it's a tragic death. So to those people that are listening that are speculate, that like to speculate about these kinds of things, I wish you'd stop. Because the important thing, Mac would find it amusing, I think, actually, because he would think that anyone would be speculating about that would be crazy too. But the thing to focus on with Mac Tonies is not his death. It's to focus on his life and the work that he left behind. And as soon as you start speculating and getting down into that crazy rabbit hole of him being offed by the man or the government or whatever, the dark forces, then you start talking about something that doesn't matter and you start missing the entire point of his life, as short as it was, which is all the good work and the good ideas that he came up with. So that's what people should focus on. Take it from me, folks. Nobody killed him. It's a tragic, tragic death at a young age, but it happens. Unfortunately, you can walk through any cemetery in any town and you'll see tombstones of people who die younger even than Mac of natural causes. I mean, unfortunately, it just happens. And unfortunately for all of us who knew him, it happened to Mac.
And just on a personal note, I've got to say, part of the reason I changed my lifestyle, because I'm just a few years older than Mac would have been now, is I was working a full-time job and basically producing 6 podcasts a week. And the reason I really decided that I had to do all of this full-time if I was going to continue is I started to have health issues, and I thought, I'm going to end up not above ground if I don't stop it. So sometimes I think, and I think it's a universal thing, I think it would be fair to call Mac an artist. And anytime you're trying to create your art and do a full-time job on the side, plus the caffeine or whatever, which I'm also guilty of, we're human and we break down.
Yeah, it can be very difficult. I mean, I was shooting my feature film in December. I actually had to leave one night. My blood pressure during that day, I have high blood pressure anyway, but I just stopped into a pharmacy. And it's kind of the legacy of Mac. It really focuses your attention on your own mortality when one of your friends dies, even younger than you are, of a heart ailment. So, high blood pressure, it's my heart that'll eventually probably kill me. Or somebody who hears me talking about them on the radio and tracks me down. I don't know. But know, I just happened to measure my blood pressure that day at a pharmacy, and it was 177/111. And over the next couple hours, it was consistently at that level. I was feeling dizzy. We were on location an hour from the city, and my executive producer, my friend Andrew from the United Kingdom, insisted that I go back to Halifax and go to the emergency room. I wasn't going to leave the set. I would have stayed there. But he said, look, you might be having a heart attack, or who knows what you're having. So by the time I get to emergency, my blood pressure was 186/112. Ooh. And they started hooking me up to a whole bunch of machines. And I used to be on blood pressure medication, and then my doctor took me off. Anyway, to make a long story short, as I was sitting there with my brother who drove me in, I actually thought to myself, you know, I do know people who passed away at younger, and Mac's not the only one, at younger ages from heart-related ailments. And part of it is the lifestyle, as you say, that you lead as an artist. Mac was an artist working two jobs. I was on set and location, and I'm sort of a high-strung individual anyway. You know, you just kind of have to step back and say, look, nothing that I do is going to be so important that I want to give up the next 40 years of my life to do it. So as it turns out, you know, I'm fine, allegedly fine. So the doctors tell me it was just an episode or whatever. A combination of things elevated my blood pressure. But still, it focuses your attention. And so that's another message. You know, if you can take something positive out of Mac's death or the death of anybody you know at a young age, focus on your own mortality, your own health, and maybe change your own lifestyle. Maybe be more aware of how you live your life. And that's definitely something that I have to admit I took out of Mac's passing, and I paid a little more attention to my own situation. So,
a good point. Now, back to one specific piece of work, and you mentioned it is one of the latter pieces of his work that I'm very interested in, is this whole idea of the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. I guess some people have drawn parallels to the work of Richard Schaefer. Mm-hmm. Schaefer. Tell us about what that theory was and Mac's take on it.
Well, it's interesting. I was with him in 2006. We were out in Southern California. I brought him along with me when I was filming Best Evidence, my documentary, Top 10 UFO Sightings. And I was with him. We were in a parking lot in Agoura, California, when he got the call from his literary agent saying, the publisher wants to publish your Crypto Terrestrials book. And his reaction at the time, and this was 2006, so 3 years before he died, 3 years before it was published. And he had been writing about this crypto-terrestrial idea. He'd been making some blog posts and stuff like that. And so when he hung up, I said, good news? And he said, yes, good news, got a book. I said, well, you don't seem terribly excited about it. And he said, well, yeah, what am I going to do now? I actually have to write it. Because he had already started to sort of lose interest in the crypto-terrestrial idea. It was a thought experiment for him where he said, look, let's take a look at these UFO cases, some of these paranormal events, and let's try and make sense of them. So it doesn't make sense to me that they're aliens from extraterrestrials from Zeta Reticuli coming to Earth. And he sort of he wanted to try something new. So he kind of had just floated it out there as a thought experiment. And I've used that word a lot, but he did those things a lot. And then it kind of, you know, he pitched it to a publisher and it kind of took hold. And he said, well, now I feel obliged. I have to write this book. And it took him, it should tell you sort of, it's not a hard theory to put your mind around. What the crypto-terrestrial thing is, it very much, you know, there are elements of the Richard Schaefer writings and all of that stuff from the 50s. That idea that the subterranean, potentially subterranean civilization, although Mac took it a little further. Mac said, they might not be the subterranean civilization. It might be a civilization that exists up here with us. So you could be a crypto-terrestrial, Jim.
I've been trying to keep that on the down low, but
that's exactly what he would say. He would say the crypto-terrestrials would be this ancient race that have existed alongside humans for as long as we've been around, even longer. But we're in the ascendant, and they're in the descendant. So they have better technology than us, but there's very few of them left. And so they have to keep themselves hidden. It's almost like watching one of the what's the vampire series? Underworld, right? Yeah.
Yes.
We have the vampires and the lycans, and they want to keep themselves basically hidden from humanity because even though they're more powerful than us, there's 6.5 billion of us, and maybe there's 3,000 of them. So the odds favor us. So it wasn't just the Schaefer thing. He was also talking about this idea. He was drawing into the old myths and legends of vampires and all these sorts of creatures that might exist, look like humans, act like humans, or at least be able to, but they're not humans. And so that was the crypto terrestrial thing. And he was saying, well, look, they would have a vested interest in the safety and security of our planet in a way that extraterrestrials from Zeta Reticuli would not. This idea that if we start setting off nuclear weapons, somehow we're going to upset the universal balance and destroy planets light years away from us, he thought was ridiculous. I think is ridiculous. So when you hear people say extraterrestrials are coming here because they're afraid our nuclear weapons are going to somehow undermine the universe, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So he looked at it logically and he said, what would make sense is somebody who had to live here. So if we actually did set off a nuclear holocaust, like the Cuban Missile Crisis could have become, they would go as well as we would. There's no, you know, so they have an interest in trying to encourage us to not do that kind of thing, to be more peaceful, to sort of advance as a species. But they can't do it overtly because we're violent and warlike and we outnumber them. So what they do is they do it by stealth. They create these images in the sky, holograms, holographs, whatever you want to call them. That's what the UFO phenomenon is. I'm really, you know, kind of giving the Coles Notes version there. He went into a lot more stuff. He talked about alleged alien abductions and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, he never finished the book. So when he died, the manuscript was recovered from his computer. There might even have been a hard copy, I'm not sure. And the publisher, to the publisher's credit, Anomalous Books, edited it and put it out there. And there's a lot of really interesting ideas in it, but it comes across, it's only 100 pages long, and it comes across as an unfinished essay, frankly. And contractually, he would have finished it because he was that kind of guy. But his heart wasn't in it towards the end. He was already looking at a whole bunch of other things, and he was moving back towards, I know from my own conversations with him, his original idea when I first met him and first started talking to him, which was that we were dealing with some form of artificial intelligence that might come from another planet. So he was starting to talk again much more about Van Neumann probes and all that sort of stuff, self-replicating probes that you would send out into the galaxy that eventually might make their way to Earth. If you look at human development, he was very interested in post-humanism and transhumanism, the idea that we may someday transcend humanity and merge with artificial intelligence or with mechanical, like cyborgs and that sort of stuff. So he was speculating on the kinds of intelligence that we were going to encounter. The crypto-terrestrial thing was always just one of those strands that he was thinking about. And towards the end, it was a strand that, you know, he became less and less interested in, which is not to demean the crypto-terrestrial thing or his book, which has a lot of interesting and worthwhile stuff in it to read. But it wasn't a theory. It certainly wasn't something that he believed was the gospel truth. It was just a thought experiment that he came up with. And then he kind of got trapped into it. You know, he kind of had to write a book about it. And he had enough material there, but he was merging a lot of stuff into it that, frankly, didn't always make sense in the context of the crypto-terrestrials, but it was interesting anyway. So the crypto-terrestrial idea was inspiring him to write about other things, even if it wasn't necessarily really about the crypto-terrestrials. It was still interesting stuff. And so that spurred him on to write about that. But I think if he was here today, I feel very confident in saying that if you asked him, well, what do you think of the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, he'd say, well, you know, it was a thought experiment. I'm glad I did it, but it's not really where my thinking is today. I think it's more likely that it's this. And who knows what this would be? He would have come up with three or four other ideas by now. So,
what do you think he would have ended up doing? Would he become like, let's say, another, what I consider young author out there who is doing great work, like a Nick Redfern, who has three or four books every year? Would he still be living the life of working the coffee house in the day of blogging at night? Where do you think his writing and his insight would have taken him?
Away from the paranormal.
Interesting.
I don't think he ever would have left the paranormal behind in the same way that I haven't or Greg Bishop hasn't, because it interests us. But he was a very good fiction writer, much more interested in terms of his writing in fiction than he was in nonfiction or even paranormal speculation. So he had short stories that he was writing. As I said, he and I collaborated on a play, which was really his first opportunity, and we were working on a couple screenplays. And that, I have no doubt that that's where he would have gone, that one of those screenplays would have been successful, or he would have written one on his own, or he would have written a book or another collection of sorts, short stories, because they were all very good. His original book, Illumined Black, was really well reviewed by other science fiction writers as well. He had drawn the attention of some very good, very well-known science fiction authors like John Shirley, who kindly gave us a quote that we used on the back of the book. And, you know, Shirley was one of his favorite authors, and he's one of mine. And Shirley was sort of a fan of Mac's blogging and of his writing and his work. So he was much more in tune with guys like Shirley and Bruce Sterling and Cliff Pickover and all these other authors in Pickover's case, in Dr. Pickover's case, you know, not writing fiction, but talking about all sorts of non-paranormal things like posthumanism, transhumanism, cutting edge frontier science, that I like, as I like to call it. He would have had all of that out in front of him. The paranormal would have been part of it, but no, he wouldn't have become like Nick Redfern. And I mean this in a very good way. Nick is incredibly good at what he does, but that's what Nick does. And Nick, by the way, Nick writes for a lot of other publications that have nothing to do with the paranormal. It's just most people in the paranormal community aren't really aware of his other work. I think he even told me he wrote for Penthouse once. So Nick's a writer. That's what he does. A lot of his books are about the paranormal, but not all of them. I think Mac would have continued to do maybe a book here or some blogging there about the paranormal. But his career, I think his life, was taking him in other directions, more in towards the entertainment industry, towards artistic endeavors, which is, I think, where his heart really lied. I mean, that's what he was really good at, writing and coming up with these crazy ideas and then creating characters around them and then putting them out there in stories that really, you know, were quite thrilling. So you can go on his website, MacTonies.com, MacTonies.com. And he has a page there which contains some of his old short stories that he never published. One or two were published online. And, you know, you can just kind of read them, and they're sort of a portrait of a young man as a science fiction writer using the paranormal, using some of the themes from the paranormal, but then sticking him into his own fictional work and creating something new out of that. So there was a relationship there. But I think he would have wound up doing more work outside the field of the paranormal than he would have inside.
What do you think his legacy is?
Far too short, unfortunately. You know, he didn't leave behind a large body of work. The Crypto-Terrestrials is only 100 pages long. Illumined Black is a pretty short work, if you can get your hands on it. And After the Martian Apocalypse is a good work, but he hadn't hit his stride yet. So that's the really sad part. He had so much more to contribute. But I think his legacy, more than anything else, is that he's encouraged an awful lot of people to take the paranormal seriously, but also beyond that, to just take the idea of creating thought experiments seriously, of having a reasoned conversation about what seems to be unreasonable subjects to a lot of people. So without the bitterness or the vindictive nature of some of these paranormal message forms and all that, which he hated and which he would have nothing to do with, he just wanted to have a rational conversation with people, like-minded people who were willing to imagine different worlds, different futures, different possibilities. And he created this following, a small following, there's no question. But he had this following of people who thought in the same way, that he inspired to think in the same way. And I think his legacy will be that as the years go on, that following will grow, that those people, it's like the old shampoo commercial, that guy will tell two guys who will tell two more guys, and eventually more people hopefully will know about Mac, know about his work, know about his ideas, but also know about just how he thought, how he encouraged other people to think and to imagine. And if the series of posthuman blues books can bring some of that out, then I think that's mission accomplished for me. But also, leaving aside the paranormal, I just think his observations about life and society and culture and who we were in the early 21st century, the first decade where really he was writing for that 6-year period, it's kind of going to be, you know, to compare him to Kurt Cobain. Kurt Cobain was that flashing star that left a relatively small body of work, but tremendously influential on music. Now, Mac's reach is not that of Kurt Cobain, but the same principle applies, that you're able to look back and you're able to get a snapshot of a particular time and place. And I think that's what the posthuman blues brings to the table. Here's a very articulate, intelligent, thoughtful guy talking about the times that he lived in and confronting them with absolutely no fear. total conviction, total courage, and willing to take the world on one day at a time without sort of stepping back and letting the world push him around. I think that's part of his legacy too. And when people read it, they'll just walk away and they'll say, yeah, I remember those times. I lived through those times. And I like the cut of this guy's jib, as I said earlier. I like the way he thinks. I like the way he acts. I want to act like that. I want to think like that. And even if you come, as most people would, to completely different conclusions than Mac, or you travel down different life paths, you know, looking at a guy like Mac is the kind of thing that encourages you to at least try that sort of stuff.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. And again, we recommend that people pick up on the book so they can read for themselves the work of Mac Tanu's. Paul, where can people find this book, all your other books, and everything that you're up to, including the conclusion of this series of books on Mac?
Sure. Our company's website, www.redstarfilmtv.com, all one word, redstarfilmtv.com. And some of my old films are there, including one that he's in. He had the closing sort of words in Best Evidence. I gave him the last word. So he had the concluding remarks. So you can see Mac, you can actually see him on camera there. But his books are available through our website. You can also get them through Amazon. And we have an ebook distribution deal where they'll, sometime over the next 2 or 3 months, they'll be available everywhere as ebooks as well. So, although I prefer the hard copies because then, you know, they won't disappear from your computer. But that's the Luddite in me speaking.
So it's a fair point. Well, Paul, as always, it is great to talk to you. We look forward to many more conversations in the future. And thank you for being a part of The Other Side today.
Thanks, Jim. Always great to talk to you. And thanks for having me on today to talk. In particular, it's been a great opportunity to just sort of talk about my old friend, Mac Tanu's. I've really appreciated it.
Thanks a lot, Paul. And thank you for tuning in to The Other Side. And we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.